So I started feeling like maybe, you know, God is just this extra explanation that we add on to this. And, you know, the people who came up with, you know, the scriptures and the whoever wrote the Old Testament, that was, you know, those were people trying to explain reality. And now we kind of know where everything comes from. We evolved from the primordial soup. And so, you know, if you want to believe in God, it's an okay addition, but it's not a necessary one.
Hello, and thanks for joining in. I'm Jana Harmon, and you're listening to the Side B podcast, where we see how skeptics flip the record of their lives. Each episode, we listen to someone who has once been an atheist, but who became a Christian to the great surprise of themselves and others. In most of the stories we've listened to so far, the former atheist had little to no Christian belief or faith or exposure to Christians or Christianity before they became atheists. But that isn't always the case. Sometimes someone is intimately connected with Christianity and then decides to leave it, decides to leave the faith and community they once loved, the beliefs they once held, not necessarily because they wanted to believe, but they felt like they had no choice. In their minds, they could not sustain intellectual belief in God or perhaps questionable moral platitudes in the face and pressures of what they may be finding or learning that opposes what they once thought was true. They find their faith crumbling against the weight of growing disbelief. They can no longer sustain their faith or intellectual integrity or even social acceptance and continue as a Christian. It becomes no longer true or real, good or relevant. Deconversion seems inevitable. Atheism seemingly becomes their only choice. That is, until it isn't. In today's story, Marie, a brilliant thinker, left the Christian faith she loved for what she thought was the intellectual respectability and truth of atheism. But her once settled atheistic presumptions were challenged, and she became open to reconsider what she once left behind. She found her way back, not to the childhood Christian faith she left behind, but to a substantive, intellectually grounded Christianity that has informed her adult thinking and sustained her life in powerful ways. I hope you'll come along and listen to her story, and that you'll stay to the end to hear her give advice to curious skeptics or even former Christians towards rethinking their faith, as well as advice to Christians on how best to think about and engage with those who don't believe. Welcome to the Side B podcast, Marie. It's so great to have you.
Oh, it's great to be here.
As we're getting started, Marie, so the listeners can know a little bit about you, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into your story?
Well, I'm Marie Wood. I'm married to David Wood. We've been married for 19 years. We have 5 boys, Lucian, Blaze, Reed, Paley, and Kepler. And I'm very busy with the boys. And also I assist David with his work. And I also co-founded a nonprofit to support families affected by the rare disease that my sons Reed and Paley share. So that pretty much occupies my time.
Okay, great. And maybe we can learn more about that as we move through your story. And for those who are listening, I'll put a link to whatever that nonprofit is in the episode notes. So let's get started with your story, Marie, so that we can know about where you grew up, the community, and the context of your belief or disbelief as a child. Why don't you just step us into that world of your family, of your childhood, of your community? Was there any sense of religion, religious belief? Was there any reference to God in that world?
So I grew up in a Roman Catholic family, and we were practicing. We went to church every Sunday. And I always remember having a strong love of God at an early age. What was interesting was that I ended up going to a Presbyterian church for preschool or for nursery and daycare. I actually heard the gospel at a very early age, and I really connected to it. And I used to just sing about Jesus all the time. And I had this little t-shirt that we made at that nursery preschool that said, "Guess who's my best friend?" And it was a picture of, you know, Jesus with the long hair. And it was my favorite shirt. I loved that shirt so much that I wore it all the way until probably first grade. But I loved God. I always had this, I used to fall asleep praying. And I just had this intense curiosity about God. I remember I was about 5 when I was trying to wrap my head around how did God begin? And I remember I was talking to my dad. I said, "Well, what was God's beginning, or when was God born?" And my dad would say, "Well, he wasn't born." And I thought maybe I wasn't asking the question in the right way. And I would try to come up with a different way and say, "Well, when did he start?" You know? And, you know, so I was curious about this concept of eternity and what that, you know, it finally clicked with me when my dad said something like, "Well, he's outside of time." And it didn't quite make sense to me, but it made probably the most sense to me when he said it like that. And I was about 5 years old, and I lost my first tooth. I was looking in the mirror, and I thought to myself, 5 years ago, I was not here. And it was scary. It was scary for me. Only looking back, I could say it was almost like a taste of my own mortality. Mm. And, you know, when you're little, you are the world. You see everything is, you know, you're kind of selfish in a way. I mean, it's childish. You see everything from your own perspective. And for me, that moment, just looking into my own reflection and thinking, 5 years ago, I was not here. Everything around me that I think is, this is the world. This is everything. My perspective is everything to me, but it wasn't even here. And like the sense of just that I'm not that big. I'm not that important in everything. And it was just kind of, it was an interesting moment, and it kind of coincided with this thought about God as eternal. You know, I had this strong devotion, and it was interesting because I was probably the most devout in my immediate family, you know, with my parents. My dad would sometimes go to church, and sometimes he would still be relaxing from his Saturday fun. And my mother, she would specifically say, "Well, I have to go and show my face." You know, it's more of like a duty. But for me, I actually experienced this joy going to church. I wanted to be there. I felt closer to God. I liked listening to the word. I liked singing. And so it was really important to me. I probably looked up to my grandparents the most as my, you know, moral guides. You know, they were churchgoers and all that. So that's kind of where I was at a very early age.
That's really quite impressive for a 5-year-old to be so thoughtful and not only introspective, but actually thinking about very deep questions like who made God or how did God begin, right? Those kind of questions.
Yeah.
And the concept of time and eternity and your own mortality. Those are big questions for a 5-year-old, but I think it gives us an indication, even from an early age, that you are an inquisitive person, a person who needs to be intellectually satisfied in some way. But that, yeah. I love also your description about the joy and devotion that you felt. So even from the beginning, we're getting a sense of who you are in terms of not only deep intellect, but also deep emotion.
Yeah, I would say that those two go hand in hand with my connection to God. And, you know, I remember the cross itself being a huge image to me and the meaning behind it. started thinking about how much Jesus must have hurt on the cross. And I remember thinking, I wonder if it's possible for me, if I hurt, can I take away other people's hurt? And let me not start crying at the beginning of my interview, but I remember I prayed to God. I said, this is sort of a strange prayer, but I told God, you know, again, I'm like 6 years old, and I told God, I think I'm stronger than other people. So if it's possible, you can let me hurt instead of other people.
Wow. So that's incredibly unselfish. I mean, your devotion to God and your selflessness based upon what you knew of Jesus and his own suffering, again, is a very deep, it's just deep and very, that you personalized it in that way, again, speaks to a maturity beyond your years at 6 years old. That's quite amazing.
Yeah. I guess I think it's important to share all this because, you know, really in this, and seeing me as an atheist at some point in my life, to understand that at the beginning, there was this really powerful connection between me and God. And, you know, and I was always thinking and wondering about God, and it was this joyful relationship. And, you know, I think about, what's his name? Eric Little in, Chariots of Fire.
He says,
and he says, when I run, I feel his pleasure. Like I feel God's pleasure. I believe I was made for China to be a missionary to China, but when I run, I feel God's pleasure. And for me, I have something similar happen when I'm just thinking. I have this sense of pleasure, like a sense of the presence of God and his delight in me as I'm thinking about things and wondering about the world. And so I was about 8 years old when I began to think about people who don't believe in God. And I found that so strange. Like, how can people not believe in God? And I even came up with kind of like my own version of Pascal's wager, where I thought, you know, it just doesn't make sense, because if God is real and you believe in him, then you go to heaven and everything's great. And then, but if you don't believe in him, then, you know, it's not going to be turn out well. But if he doesn't exist and you believe in him, you know, nothing bad happens. And, you know, if he doesn't exist and you don't believe in him, nothing, you know, doesn't really change anything. So I told this to my dad, and he thought it was, you know, a great idea. And he said, yeah, you should tell grandma and grandpa about that. And so, you know, at some point I was talking to them on the phone. And like I said, they were sort of my spiritual role models. And I started telling them my thoughts about it, and they could see where I was going, and they kind of almost cut me off, like right before I really finished my conclusion. And they both, I guess they had me on speakerphone because they were both responding to me. And they were like, no, honey, no, you know, God doesn't want us to come up with reasons to believe in him. And he just wants a pure faith. And I was sort of chagrined because I thought I was going to be praised for, so I was a little surprised, but it also kind of created this sort of chink in my spiritual world. Like, okay, so you're telling me that thinking and reasoning is not a part of being a faithful follower of God and Jesus. So that was sort of a big wedge, because, you know, as you could tell, I was sort of a bright child, and I liked academics, and I was a high achiever. And so that was a part of my identity, and you know, being a good student and learning things. So it was at that point I kind of created, okay, so religion is this compartment that's separate from all of me. It's this one little part of me now. Mm. And it didn't impact me instantly, but I can look back and say over time, my faith was becoming watered down in a sense. I mean, I still had this connection to God. I still felt emotionally connected to God. And yet, again, you know, as I'm going through high school and kind of becoming more of, you know, a God is sort of a good guy and, you know, all religion, you know, there are these other religions, surely all these good people are not going to hell. And so, like, you know, my concept of the gospel is getting a little bit more expanded or shifting a little bit. And once I got into college, you know, as a science major, as a double major in biology and psychology, and you really just get inundated with a materialistic worldview, a physicalist worldview. Everything is physical. A lot of psychology, you know, there's a nurture nature debate, but a lot of it boils down to your physiology and your biology. And so, in biology, you just get really impressed that with the theory of evolution, that it's the basis for everything. And I also took a philosophy class in my first semester at college, and my professor was an atheist, and I loved that guy. I love that guy. We had great banter because at that time I was still professing Christianity. And, you know, I remember writing my final paper where I was still defending the faith, and I was defending the existence of God and the immortality of the soul. And I think my argument was based on, you know, like musical improvisation and how there must be something more than just the physical world, and because, you know, we sense it and how we feel about things. And it did, you know, again, it was still because of all this skepticism, I guess, I was sort of being impressed with this notion that everybody who is in academia just doesn't believe in God, or they don't believe in traditional Christianity. It's not really what smart people are supposed to think. And so that was getting to me in a subtle way. And I would say, by my second year of college, I was, you know, my concept of God at that point was very, abstract, you know, definitely not a personal God, definitely not the triune God of Christianity. Jesus was a really wonderful person. He was divine in the sense that he was extremely enlightened and loving and moral. And God was, you know, the force of life and creation in the universe, like whatever that creative impulse that allows life to exist. And, I mean, I even said to my dad one time, we were talking, and I said, I don't believe in God anymore. And my dad's, yeah. And he was shocked because that was so strange for him to hear from me, of all people, so.
I'd like to take a moment to tell you about an upcoming C.S. Lewis Institute online event. We all know someone who is suffering right now in one way or another. It seems inescapable. When we hear of a friend who's struggling, it can be easy to say, I'm praying for you, but harder to know actually what to pray or how to understand why difficult things happen. Nancy Guthrie has written a new book called I'm Praying for You, where she teaches us how to pray for those who are hurting through using the words of the Bible. She also shows us how God's purposes are revealed even in and through our darkest days, and encourages us to pray for His will instead of our own through challenging situations. I hope you'll join us online on January 21st at 8 p.m. Eastern Time to hear Nancy talk about how to pray for others who are suffering. There's no charge for this event, but you do need to register at www.cslewisinstitute.org. Now back to our story.
So when you went to college, obviously there was a real paradigm shift that started happening there. If you went to college and your faith at that point was more emotional, this personal connection, you had separated your reason from your devotion to God, then you move into this, as you were talking about your atheist philosopher professor, and you were trying to defend you know, the existence of God. At that point, you were required in some form or fashion to defend God's existence intellectually. It sounded like you tried to do that. I wonder at that point, were you probably a couple of things. One is that, were you finding any kind of intellectual or rational kinds of evidences or arguments for God at that time? Or were you just drawing from what you knew or what you felt or what like you say, you're a thinker. Were you drawing kind of from your abstract thoughts about it? So you weren't finding a grounded intellectual rationality for God?
No, I would say my thinking at that point, my arguments for God were more subjective. And, you know, it was clear that I didn't even know there was such a thing as providing evidences for God, because, you know, again, like I was 8 years old and I was told that that's not a part of our faith. And so I had no idea that there were all these discussions happening, and my professor certainly didn't point me to any books about the topic. And I think what happened with, you know, being a biology major and studying evolution so much, I mean, evolution was part of all my classes. I mean, even my creative writing teacher was talking about evolution one day, you know, well, what do you think the first sound that people evolved, you know, probably a lament or a cry, and, you know, So I started feeling like maybe, you know, God is just this extra explanation that we add on to this. And, you know, the people who came up with, you know, the scriptures and whoever wrote the Old Testament, that was, you know, those were people trying to explain reality. And now we kind of know where everything comes from. We evolved from the primordial soup. And so, you know, if you want to believe in God, it's an okay addition, but it's not a necessary one. And this is a big reversal of where I was as a child.
I guess instead of God creating man, man created God.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And that you, I guess, through these courses and these looking at these examples of thinkers and educated people and academics, those people didn't need God, and that you as an intellectual, I'm sure, saw yourself as someone who perhaps doesn't need God as well. And
yeah, exactly. And oftentimes they were antagonistic towards Christianity and Christian values, especially. So, you know, Christians are seen as judgmental and close-minded and anti-intellectual. So I was kind of imbibing all of this, and it obviously had detrimental effects on my faith. So,
then you decided to leave it all behind, and you identified as an atheist then in college.
Yeah. As I said, I did clearly say to my father, I don't believe in God anymore. But then when I said that, I sort of felt something in my heart like, do I really mean it that way? And then so I kind of redefined God. I couldn't quite say that I don't believe at all. But I sort of redefined him as I said, the sort of impersonal creative force in the universe. And, you know, when mankind does good things towards others, that's, you know, God, that's love. That's what we're talking about. I actually had this traumatic experience that I would say that when I stopped believing in God and Christianity, you know, in the Orthodox sense, or, you know, and the concepts that were connected to God also began to crumble or shift in a way. So God was a foundational belief, and, you know, even the crucifixion of Jesus and saving the world, like, these were all like the foundation for everything that I thought about. And so to take those away, that everything started like shifting and rebalancing, I guess. And I started, I had this, you know, traumatic experience, and I started even questioning whether unconditional love was real. I didn't feel like the world was the place that I once thought it was. And and I felt a lot. I had a sense of loss, but it wasn't enough for me to believe in God. Like, I can't believe in it if I don't think it's real. I remember my an aunt of mine was, like I said, most of my family is Catholic, but I have this one uncle who became an evangelical when he was young. And he and his wife used to talk to me a lot. I guess they could see a kind of openness to me, in me, towards the gospel. And they had come to visit. They were in town and we were at the beach. And my aunt was sitting next to me and I was looking at the water. And she said, "You know, Maria, I remember you used to say you prayed every night and you felt you've always loved Jesus and all these things." She said, "Do you still pray? Or do you still feel that way about Jesus?" And when she asked me that, I started crying. And I said, "I miss Jesus. I miss him." And, you know, she kind of put her arm around me and she said, "Well, you know, God bless you for your sensitivity. And, you know, I'm praying for you." But again, just because I wanted to believe in Jesus, I still thought Christianity was the most beautiful philosophy that I'd ever studied or heard of or read. And I studied world religions. You know, I read the Mahabharata and I studied the Analects and, Buddhism, all these things. And Christianity was still the most beautiful to me, the most attractive. But if it wasn't real, I couldn't say that I believe, I couldn't deceive myself that way, no matter how much I wanted to.
So you still saw beauty in it. It wasn't as if you turned to, as some of your, I guess, professors had done, just to ridicule and speak of the immorality or the, all of that of it, that you actually still saw something worth believing in. You just couldn't, because you didn't think it was intellectually viable.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So step us on from here. What happened next?
Well, then I, through a series of uncoincidences, I ended up at a rehearsal for the college speech and debate team. And there I met my future husband, David Wood, and also Nabil Qureshi. And so I just, like I said, it was a series of uncoincidences, but I ended up in this rehearsal and the coach just instantly loved me. She just loved me. And she said, "What, you know, Marie, why don't you join us for our next tournament?" And I said, "Well, I don't have anything to do." She says, "Oh, you can do an impromptu speech. And we have an extra ticket because somebody dropped out." So I agreed to go on this debate tournament or speech and debate tournament the next weekend, you know, with nothing prepared. I was just going to observe and then do an impromptu speech. And when I got to the airport for that trip, I immediately spotted David and Nabil because they were so tall. So one of their nicknames on campus was, like, you know, the two towers, and they're both over 6 feet tall. And so I walk over there, you know, because I have to establish my dominance and superiority to find the biggest guys to take on. And they were debating whether or not Jesus rose from the dead. And I'm listening to them for a second. And then I decide it's time for me to get attention. And I go, "Well, you can both be right." And they look at me and David says, he was like, "No," he's like, "either I'm right and he's wrong, or we could both be wrong, but, you know, we can't both be right on this. Either Jesus Christ rose from the dead or he didn't." And I was like, "Well, you know, the important thing about religion is that even if you have different beliefs, it all comes down to the same thing, that we need to love our fellow human beings and, you know, try to be decent to each other and yada, yada." And David says, "Don't give me that. I come from the trailer park." You know, as if he's, like, establishing his legitimacy with his humble origins. So I kind of roll my eyes and I was like, "Well, whatever. I come from single-celled organisms." And he his jaw kind of dropped and he was like, what? And then so we got into this little debate about that. So, but he's, well, and this is what's interesting, because as you said, I didn't actually have an aversion to Christianity itself, but for some reason, what came out of me in that moment was what I got from my culture, from my professors and everything. And I was mocking him and he would try to contend with me. And I was so mean. And if you know me, it's weird because I'm not normally mean, but I was so mean. I kind of joke that it's almost a miracle that he even wanted to talk to me after this. Because I was so mean, I was nonstop ridiculing and mocking him. And like, he would try to speak and I would burst out laughing. And it was a divine intervention, because I don't know who'd want to talk to somebody after they were that nasty. But we did, we kept talking through that tournament. We talked on the plane and, you know, he's engaging with Nabil, who was a Muslim at the time and later became a famous evangelist as well. And one of the things that hit me with David was when he told me that he used to be an atheist. And I thought, wow, so you used to be an atheist. And I noticed as we were talking and having these little arguments that he was smart, and he was really smart, and that I couldn't just brush him aside the way that I did, you know, some other Christians that I had met, or evangelical Christians that I had met, who I thought who were anti-intellectual, who were, you know, opposed to any type of higher education, and like, because they thought it was just brainwashing and all this stuff. I mean, it can be in a sense, but you know, obviously, if you present that to somebody who's intellectually inclined, that's not going to be attractive, but. So David really shook my stereotype of and some assumptions that I had about Christians, that, you know, you only end up that way when you're born that way, or, I mean, you're raised that way. And to see someone who was as smart as him, who I couldn't just wipe the floor with intellectually in a debate, and, that he could actually really stand his ground. And then this concept that you can know that Christianity is true because Jesus rose from the dead. That was different, you know? And I said, well, okay, I could see historical evidence that he died on the cross. And I believe that he died on a cross. And I was like, but you can't prove that he rose from the dead. And so these were the conversations we were having, and it was the end of the semester. So we had exams coming up. But David and I started meeting every day to talk about these things. So we'd meet to study, and we'd be, you know, studying our stuff. And then I'd take breaks and read the books that he was giving me. So he was giving me things like More Than a Carpenter, The Case for Faith, some books about the resurrection by Yuri Habermas, Icons of Evolution, which was put out by the Discovery Institute. And so I'd read these books and I would kind of get like huffy. I would be mad, especially with the ones that were contradicting evolution. I would get like irritated. And David would kind of laugh at me because he'd say, well, what's wrong? I was like, well, they're just making it sound like evolution is stupid. And so it's okay for me to make fun of you for not believing it, but you can't make fun of me for believing it.
Right. So, and in the meantime, you're still pursuing, I think you were pursuing medicine at the time, right? And still studying evolutionary biology.
Yeah.
And all of your coursework. And yet you were having this counter perspective. So did it cause you to question evolutionary biology at that time, or really what was underpinning your atheistic worldview?
Yeah. Yeah. That was the big challenge. So, because I, you know, again, like I felt like, you know, God and all attendant beliefs, you know, the idea of a personal God and creator, I mean, that's unnecessary if you believe that everything just evolved, by accident. And, it was, And what hit me about some of these books I was reading that were countering evolution and providing, you know, counterclaims, was that some of the very examples that I used to tell David, like, I mean, it's irrefutable, were, you know, staged photographs of butterflies that were pinned on tree trunks, like they, you know, that were presented to be like a natural photograph, but they were staged photographs. There were hoaxes like Heckel's embryos and things like that. And I said, but those are in the textbooks. And I was like, why would they still have them there? And so, I mean, even if evolution were true, it's not this impenetrable fortress that I thought it was. Mm. And certainly not what I want to be basing my life choices and my concept of morality on at this, you know, as I started to realize this. So that was really shaking kind of the core of my new worldview. And there was this one moment we were sitting on, you know, this sofa, and he was studying for his exams and I was reading one of these books. And I had this experience that I was looking at the mirror in my childhood bedroom, which was like, over the years, I had just like covered it up with like these little Mardi Gras beads and sashes and stickers and pictures of friends. And, you know, I really could barely see myself in this mirror, you know, just like in the very middle. And it was like, I was standing in front of that mirror again, and all those things were gone. And I was just looking at myself, and I could see myself as I truly was in all my rebellion. And I could see like that I was rejecting God, based on lies, and that I had really been willfully turning away from him, the one who loved me the most. And it hurt to see myself like that. And I just started weeping and sobbing. I was like shaking with sobs. And David was, you know, he's kind of startled, and he just quietly put his book down and put his arm around me, and he said, "What's wrong?" And I looked at him, you know, tears streaming down my face, and I said, I'm wrong. And he invited me to church like the following Sunday, like after that day on that couch. And the pastor did an invitation. He gave an invitation, and he said, you know, look to the person on your right and then look to the person on the left, and tell them if you want to go up and profess Jesus that you'll go with them. And David was to my right. So when the pastor said this, I kind of turned to the left. And then I could feel him waiting for me. So I kind of slowly turned back at him, and then he repeated the pastor's invitation, and I said, yes, I want to go up. So we went up and, you know, we prayed as a group, and I didn't like have this any sudden feeling at that moment, but I did, you know, I did feel happy. I noticed a difference the next day.
What was that?
It's sort of silly, but I turned on the TV, and it was Real World, you know, an MTV program with like these singles who like live together, and there's all this drama. And I remembered I'd watched it like a few days ago or a week before, and I was just laughing at their antics and their foolishness. But I remember this day I turned it on and I started watching it, and I thought to myself, how empty and meaningless, and there's nothing attractive about this. And I was like, it's just so, you know, there's just this empty, vapid type of lifestyle. And I realized that I had begun to see the world differently, like instantly. And I called it receiving like Christian eyes. And so it was sort of a silly example, but something instantly changed in me and like how I began to see things. And I guess you could say, because there was that foundation, you know, leading up to it, but, yeah, something had shifted.
I'd like to pause for a moment and tell you about a wonderful way for you to take a closer, more intentional look at an important area of your life that's often neglected. When a new year rolls around, we often consider many areas in need of attention in our lives, and we set new personal goals. Every year, many of us will go through a physical checkup or a performance review at our workplace. But how often do we take time to review our spiritual life? The C.S. Lewis Institute Annual Spiritual Checkup is designed to help you take a closer look at your spiritual life over the past year and to prayerfully seek God's help in areas where you sense He desires you to grow in the new year. There are strategic questions, articles, and video talks that are designed to help you think through pivotal spiritual areas in your own life. I hope you'll take a look at this complimentary resource. You can access the C.S. Lewis Spiritual Checkup at the Institute website by typing in www.cslewisinstitute.org/ASC. Now back to our story.
Sounds like something pretty dramatically had shifted. It sounds like really, obviously, spiritually, something had opened and something had shifted, and the way that you viewed the world was completely different. Leading up to that, your mind had been changed, and I love the way that you describe the way that you look at yourself in the mirror. It reminds me of when you were five. You know, looking at your eye so closely and actually seeing something, thinking more deeply. And there you are looking at yourself again, but maybe not just your eye, but yourself.
Yeah. And my soul, and my spirit.
Yeah, exactly. Seeing your soul and feeling a sense of alienation and pushing back and longing for, again, what you had found to be true and real, something you thought was lost, but now was found in a sense. And then you found yourself in that.
Yeah.
That's really quite extraordinary. So after that first moment, how would you say in thinking about living, it sounds like you lived for a while in disbelief and that life perhaps was different in the way that you perceived it, and maybe even the way you felt it or lived it. Again, you're an intuitive person. How would you say that your life transformed? Did it go back to that kind of childhood devotion that you had, but yet not just that it was probably a more full, holistic, mind and heart and life kind of thing, that you didn't have to segregate your rationality and intellect from your faith? How did that work its way out?
Well, it was exciting. It was thrilling because now I knew there were all these things I could learn about with God. And so immediately the emotional connection is reestablished, and that I'm connected to God again. But also just this hunger and passion to know more. And David had gotten me a Bible, and I was just, and it was this giant study Bible that was like, I don't know, like 3 inches thick or something. And I was just bringing it to school, sitting in the cafeteria at our university, and I've got this huge Bible. And, and I'm reading it, and I mean, just this hunger and thirst to know more. And it was just, I was so excited. Like a whole new world had opened up to me. It was so engaging. I felt stimulated intellectually in a way that I'd never had been before. And, and then of course at this time, David and I, our relationship is growing, and we had attraction while we were still on opposite sides, and it was fun doing it, being not enemies, but in opposition.
Adversaries, and, maybe, in that sense.
It that was fun for me, and while still liking each other, but then to to kind of shift into this place where we're both on the same page spiritually, and then to both be intellectually engaged with God and each other. It was really like a three chord binding in that relationship, like between David and me and God, and just us having this mutual passion to know more and to also share that with others. And that's obviously played out in our lives as he's become, you know, in his ministry, and then I support him with that. So
if someone was looking at your story or listening to your story, looking at your life, and they said, oh, I love what you just said, because I think that the tendency would be to say, oh, she just believes in God because she fell in love. And, you know, she, but going back to your early reason for leaving the love of God for being intellectually honest, I would imagine someone like you could not believe just because they fell in love with someone who was a believer that in order to maintain your intellectual integrity, you saw its beauty, but you couldn't believe it, even though you wanted to. But now you obviously found something, like you say, that was not only beautiful but true, and that absolutely. That was a grounded. There was a groundedness, a substantive nature to it. I mean, if someone kind of spoke to you or spoke at you about that, how would you respond?
Well, I would say, you know, maybe they need to check their own stereotypes and biases. And I feel like it's sort of demeaning in a sense to just assume that, oh, a woman falls in love and that's, you know, that's why she believes what she believes. I think that I can stand enough on my own intellectual accomplishments that I don't have to say that, you know, I have to be controlled and guided by somebody else. I mean, I thrive in antagonistic scenarios and taking on the man and pushing back against the powers that be. And I mean, I can talk about that later. But I mean, I do that all the time. That's like who I am.
You are definitely a very strong and independent and brilliant woman in your own right. And so it's like another presumption you had said earlier, you know, you know, people just believe because that's how they were raised, or, you know, there are a lot of things in your story that, you know, go against that, just like David. David wasn't raised a Christian. And now he believes it. And so there are rational evidential reasons, and as well as just spiritual reasons and emotional reasons and existential reasons. There's this whole plethora of reasons to believe in the reality of God. And your life and your story really demonstrates that. So as we're coming to a close in your story, there are a lot of things I think that you could say to someone who is a curious skeptic, maybe somebody who looks at the Christian and sees something that is attractive, like, you know, the joy that you describe, but yet the intellectual depth, you know, and that you like you and David, who are brilliant people, can believe in God and do so for good reason and good grounding. And it's not just something that you want. What would you say to someone who may be open towards taking a second look, or maybe even a first look at Christianity?
Well, I would say be open, but I think probably anyone listening to this, I'm already preaching to the choir on some level, but I think that spending time reflecting on reasons you might not want to believe that have nothing to do with whether or not Christianity is true might be fruitful. To just really, you know, get real with yourself and say, is there maybe something else that it's not so much that Christianity isn't true, but apart from that, there might be other issues that you're contending with. Because, you know, each of us is a whole person. It's not just intellectual or emotional. There are other things. I think you know, you're going to meet crummy Christians. And I would say, don't let them be the standard by which you judge Christianity. Maybe have a little leeway and ask yourself, do those Christians that I dislike, or the Christians that hurt me or that I find judgmental, do they really reflect who Jesus is? You know, look into Jesus's life and his teachings, and think about how he lived, and you know, and look for Christians that seem to be reflecting that, and learn from them if you really want to learn about the Christian life. You know, keep seeking and reading, and read both sides. I think that I have so much conviction that Christianity is true. I believe it can withstand all of that scrutiny. But, you know, it's probably just finding, making that time, and, you know, give it a chance, and spend time reflecting and thinking, and, you know, God bless you if you're on that journey.
Yeah, that's good wisdom and advice, just towards being open, really, and pursuing where the evidence leads. So, mm-hmm. with regard to Christians, Marie, you've spoken about crummy Christians and really contrasted them with more genuine Christians, those who try to follow and walk with Jesus more closely, and their lives reflect that.
Yeah.
But you've also given, and may you and David both, just an incredible example, as well as Nabil, of course, and what it might look like to be someone who is very bright and intellectually astute and able to go toe to toe with just about anyone who comes against them. So how would you advise us as Christians to either prepare, or how we should live or engage with those who don't believe?
Well, I mean, definitely in my story, I know it comes up a lot with certain stereotypes. I think that breaking stereotypes is important. And so that comes from, you know, Christians developing their own intellectual life, because I think that's a huge stumbling block in our culture. That's very, science minded, and, you know, so I think that, nurturing your intellectual life as a Christian, and also your spiritual life. I think sometimes, especially with the intellectual type Christians, you can kind of miss that piece a little bit, like how important that is, because, it was Maya Angelou. She said, you know, people might forget what you say, but they won't forget how you made them feel. And, it's probably a bad paraphrase, but something like that, you know. And so, you know, I think that developing your closeness to God is so important to how you convey him to others, and, you know, practicing the presence of God, like truly practicing that presence of God and knowing him on that deep level. And I think it kind of frees you from the sense that everything's resting on you. Like, I think that it's a mistake to think, you know, I've got to win this argument, I've got to persuade this person right now. But that might not be your part in their story. And each person is different. So we really have to be spiritually sensitive to where they are, and to be listening to God, and like how we speak to people. And, you know, Jesus said that eternal life is to know him and the one who sent him. And so when we know Christ, we're already partaking in an eternal life right now. We're already beginning to partake of that life. And we can offer a taste of immortality to others the more we dwell in that, in our reality, and let it bear fruit in our lives. And I think that can be very attractive and persuasive and true. So that's my advice to Christians.
Yeah, that's, I think that's a really great word, something that's really, especially in apologetic circles, maybe not not emphasized as much, right? But yeah. There's something really amazing. I know C.S. Lewis talks about it a lot, that we have through Christ the divine power to partake of God and for God to demonstrate mm-hmm. himself through us. And that, you know, that really is the core of who we are and what we believe and how we live. And there's something really wonderful about that. Thank you for reminding us, Marie. As we're closing our conversation, is there anything that we've missed or anything else you'd like to add here at the end? That you might have wanted to say, or if not, that's fine too.
You know, I would say that God has become even more a present reality to me. As I mentioned, I have two children with a chronic illness, and I feel as though I'm a sentinel on the borderland between life and death. I've had to revive my children after finding them dead and flatlined. And I have experienced miracles. I've come to the end of my rope. I mean, I would say I'm a very resilient person, but even human resilience comes to an end. And that's where you begin to find that miracles happen and that God is really present in your life. And he's with me always. And I truly hope and pray that my story can encourage others and deepen their faith or lead them closer to God in some way.
Oh, I'm sure that it will. It really is beautiful, Marie. I love that, just not only your vulnerability, but also the stories and the thoughtfulness of everything, even from a child, you know, the depth of the way that you felt and that you thought. And it is just a beautiful strand throughout. And here again at the end, I think the Lord really takes your story and your life, and he weaves such a beautiful tapestry, even through, obviously, you've dealt with some incredible pain and difficulties, but yet he is there, and you are a living, embodied example of everything you speak of. So thank you so much for coming on today and sharing your life and your journey with us.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks for tuning into the Side B podcast today to hear Marie's story. You can find out more about her website, and the things that she was talking about on our episode notes. For questions and feedback about this episode, you can reach me by email at thesidebpodcast@cslewisinstitute.org. If you enjoyed it, I hope that you'll follow, rate, review, and share the Side B podcast with your friends and social network. In the meantime, I'll be looking forward to seeing you next time, where we'll see how another skeptic flips the record of their life.